Hi, my name is Steve Kirsch, and I'm Executive Director of the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund. We're told that the vaccines today are safe and effective, but is that really true? In this presentation, I will examine this statement, and I think you'll find the results are quite surprising. Let's start with the story of Simone Scott. I read this tweet. And it said 19-year-old Simone Scott was excited to get her second dose of Moderna's COVID vaccine on May 1. Now her mother, Valerie Kramer, is arranging her funeral. The sad thing is that Simone Scott is not alone. The question that we have to ask is how many more healthy Americans must die before we say enough? How much longer are we going to look the other way and pretend that these vaccines are safe? There are over 25,000 excess deaths that have happened since December 20th, 2020, when vaccinations started. Now, if it wasn't the vaccines that killed these people, what was it? Well, the CDC is not investigating. There are no reports that tell us what these people really died from. They refuse to reveal the number of Americans who have been killed or disabled from these vaccines. It's a secret. Nobody knows the number. There's a VSafe database that's used for reporting, but it's kept secret. And the CDC, and I know from insiders who work there, they're focused on getting more people vaccinated. They're not focused on looking at the safety data. The mainstream media is ignoring all of these stories of people who have died. They're focused on getting more people to be vaccinated. And if they admitted they were wrong, nobody would trust them again. So the fact checkers are going to obscure the truth. They're going to make it look like nobody's really dying from these vaccines. Now, have you ever wondered if the vaccines are so safe, then why do we need to waive liability for the drug companies? I'm going to go through a bunch of items today. We're going to show you proof that there are over 25,000 excess deaths, and most all of those are due to the vaccine. I'm going to show you that we don't have informed consent and we need informed consent. We'll talk about alternatives, these early treatments, and we'll talk about a lot of unethical behaviors that have happened over the past couple of years. And we'll end with some action items, things that each of you can do to try to set things right. So let's start by looking at the VAERS database. This is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And then we'll look at the total excess deaths. So the VAERS database is a voluntary database, so it underreports. But the total excess deaths is from the CDC's numbers, and those are accurate. So we'll look first at VAERS, which will be around 5,000 or so deaths. And then we'll look at the total excess deaths, 25,000. And so anything that's in VAERS, you kind of multiply by around 5 and you get the correct number of deaths that were unexpected. So let's go into it. So let's bring up OpenVAERS. And OpenVAERS is just another way to look at the VAERS database. It's run by volunteers. And let's look at the COVID vaccine data and click over to it. And there are a bunch of red boxes here that say, you know, we're up to close to 6,000 deaths now, 2,000 heart attacks and so forth. And there is a way to view all the reports. So we're going to go click on search, and we're going to select 2021, and we will select deceased, and we will not specify a state, a gender, age range. Let's put 20 to 30. Okay. And this is just to show you how obvious it is, because 20, if you're 20 or 30, you don't drop dead after you get a vaccine. You know, older people may die at any time, but when you're in the range of 20 to 30, you're pretty much not gonna, if you're there one day, you're pretty much there the next day. So let's just look at this age range just to give you a flavor for it. And then I'll just kind of zoom out and give you a bigger picture. So we search the, should have hit the search down here. So 20 to 30 report received in 2021. Let's do the search. Okay, so there are 55 records here, and they kind of summarize it, onset 3 days. So onset doesn't necessarily mean when you died, but it usually corresponds. So let's look at some of the records. So to look at the records, you click the VAERS ID, and then you can go in and look at the record. So they got vaccinated. So this person got vaccinated on the 21st, and the onset date is the 21st, and they died. They basically died the same day. Let's return to the results page. So that's one of them. The next one basically died 3 days later. Let's take a look at the details here. Sudden cardiac death after vaccine patient experienced headache, chills, fatigue, chest pain, did not seek medical care, witnessed cardiac arrest less than 3 days after vaccine number two. So I would say that, you know, most people would look at this and say the vaccine killed him. And most people would look at the other one and say the vaccine killed him because it was on the same day. Let's return to the results page and let's look some more. Okay, let's look at this one. Days to onset, zero. So he got vaccinated on the 17th. Onset date of death was the 17th. After receiving the second dose of the vaccine, complained of stomach pain and feeling bloated. Later had muscle pain, insomnia, and nausea. Found dead at home on 6-1. So essentially 13 days later, he was found dead at home. But we don't know when he died. Let's go back to the results page. So here's another one. On April 15th, an otherwise healthy 30-year-old daughter of my cousin passed away in a hospital from a massive stroke and seizures related to encephalitis of unknown cause. She recovered easily from COVID-19, but she didn't survive the vaccine. She had no lingering effects. This person didn't need to be vaccinated. She was given a single dose of the Moderna vaccine along with her colleagues. She initially complained of mild nausea and vomiting, but quickly developed a severe headache, prompting her to visit her local ER, where she received treatment for migraine. Well, migraines are a big symptom of this vaccine, because what happens is the spike protein goes into your brain, and it opens up the blood-brain barrier, and all sorts of crap come in. So migraines are like a huge tip-off that this is vaccine related. She returned to the ER at least one more time after no relief from the headache. By April 3rd, Saturday, she no longer recognized her sister, nor knew what a mask was for. Her family rushed her again to the same ER. She was subsequently transferred the following day to hospital. Due to dangerously high intracranial pressure, she suffered a stroke with paralysis on the left side and seizure. Multiple lesions were noticed on her brain via MRI. A shunt was inserted to relieve the pressure. She was intubated and placed in a deep coma from which she would never awaken. 30-year-old. Otherwise healthy 30-year-old. She never had to be vaccinated. What do you think? I think the vaccine killed her. Let's look some more. Here's our next one. He died. Basically, he got vaccinated on the 10th. He died on the 11th. You think it might be the vaccine or just coincidence? 30-year-old. He died. So let's look at this one. 527, complaining of shortness of breath, cough, fevers, chills, and fainting at the injection site. 527. On 528, same symptoms. And it looks like this person died. Date died, the 28th. So, got the vax on 26th, started symptoms on the 27th, date died 28th. You think it might be vaccine related? Yeah, probably. That's what I would guess. You know, so we can go on and on and on here. And I encourage you to check out VAERS yourself and look at these deaths. But, you know, this has been in plain sight the entire time. You know, I talked today earlier to a guy who's been tracking this since December, and he knew as early as January that the reports were off the charts. The deaths were off the charts. Now, this guy, you know, he doesn't live very far from where I am. And if he's trying, this is not his job. He was kind of doing this as a hobby just to see what was going on. But he knew back in January. It's now the middle of June. And we have all these deaths. But the safety signal was going off on January. Nobody was looking. Nobody cared. Look at this. This is what the deaths normally look like for vaccine. Look what happens with this vaccine. It's off the charts. 6,000 deaths versus normally you see maybe 300 deaths. It's a factor of 20. I mean, that is unbelievable, right? Oh, there's no safety signal here. You know, people can live. This is in plain sight. Nobody looks to see. I mean, I've talked to the FDA. They say, oh, we don't see a safety signal. Do you see anything wrong here? It looks a little suspicious to me. So let's look at cardiac. This is really interesting. They show the incidence of age for myocarditis and pericarditis. Oh, look, the young kids are getting myocarditis and pericarditis. When does that ever happen? Where the younger you are, the more you get heart problems? It's supposed to be the other way around, isn't it? Don't older people get heart problems, you know, versus younger people? Look at this. I mean, this is totally strange. And look, heart attacks post-vaccine by onset. Number of days, 0. So you get the most heart attacks right after vaccination. Now, what's supposed to happen is it's supposed to be completely flat, because the vaccination is essentially a non-event because it's safe and effective. But it's clearly not, right? Because people are dying right after the vaccine between, you know, zero. The most common time of death is right after you were vaccinated. The second most common time of death is a day after you were vaccinated. The third most common time of death is 2 days after you were vaccinated. Come on, you don't need to have a very high IQ to figure this one out. Now look at this for age under 50, right? Because, you know, some of these people just died normally, right? Well, it's the same thing. You know, you're looking at a huge number of heart attacks on for people under 50. Like, and it just so happens that it coincides with the distance from the vaccination. Now, if that's not cause and effect, I don't know what is. And I don't know how people can look at this data and not conclude that maybe the vaccine had something to do with it. Because when I look at this, I see cause and effect. But when the FDA looks at this, they see no safety signal. And the CDC doesn't see a safety signal either. I guess I'm just a dumb engineer from MIT. Let's look at blood clot. Okay, we have, I think there's one more here, the viral infections maybe. Okay, let's try the myocarditis and pericarditis. Okay, so, you know, we saw this graph earlier, right? incidence by age. Yeah, that's kind of weird. So, you know, this is all deaths for all ages, right? Sort of peaks at one day. And then if you're less than 7 years old, again, it peaks right at when they give the vaccination. Now, it's supposed to be completely flat. It's supposed to look like this. It's supposed to, like, not even, it's just be total flatline. This is the vaccine cost the deaths. And there are a lot of deaths. So if you look at the open virus data, there are, let's see, the red, for COVID, there are almost 6,000 deaths. And it's underreported by about a factor of five, maybe four or five, because we're going to show you that the another way to look at the deaths, which is in the CDC data. So anyway, this is pretty scary, right? There's not only deaths, but there's hospitalizations, urgent care visits, office visits. You know, office visits, I talked to Brian Tyson, and he says he gets the ratio of office visits due to the vaccine are 10 to 1 versus COVID. So instead of it being the vaccine is solving a problem, it's actually creating lots of work. And I talked to another doctor and he said, that's 4 to 1. 4 to 1. In other words, he gets 4 cases of vaccine side effects for every 1 case of COVID. So we've gone from COVID being a problem. Now the vaccine is causing most of these office visits and hospitalizations. It's almost like whack-a-mole. It's a little bit frustrating here. So let's take a look at the CDC data. Now, this guy named Austin Walters sent me this in DM on Twitter, and I had not seen this before. So he shows you the vaccination rates, and you can see it going up and up and up, and you know it sort of flat lines here. It doesn't keep going up here. It tapers off because people who now we're going after the vaccine hesitant. You know, this is why we have prizes and all that stuff for the vaccine. And there's a reason for the vaccine hesitancy, because if you look at the, it turns out that this vaccine doesn't just stay in your shoulder. It goes to all parts of your body, including your ovaries and your bone marrow. And yeah, it generates this spike protein, which turns out not to be benign. It's quite toxic. And it breaks off too, and it goes into the bloodstream. And when it's in the bloodstream, it can go into your brain. And in fact, it goes into your brain as well. And it starts cranking out spike protein inside your brain and inside your heart and inside, you know, all your organs, especially your ovaries and bone marrow. And there's some extra, you know, it's cleared in the liver, and there's a lot at the injection sites, not shown on this graph. But this is troubling, that a lot of it is creating this toxic spike protein in your daughter's ovaries. So here's what the graphs look like for estimated mortality by week. And this is the mortality from influenza and pneumonia. Now this red line, this is the unexplained deaths. And as you can see, it kind of remains steady until around here, which is somewhere around December 20th, or December 19th, which just happens to coincide with when we started vaccination. And so what we're seeing here is these excess deaths start to go up when we start doing vaccination. And when we've tapered off the vaccinations and everybody has been vaccinated and the vaccine centers are clear, it starts dropping. Well, but it's actually dropping because we don't have all the reports in, because the reports aren't current. So that's another reason that it's dropping. But the point is this, the excess, because, you know, it takes like 4 weeks or more. Yeah, it could happen in 2 weeks. I've talked to people who've gotten VAERS reports in 2 weeks. But basically, you're starting to see these excess deaths go up at the same time you started vaccinating people. And the nice thing about the CDC data here is that it's complete. It's 100% reported. So what we do is we go over to the CDC website, the weekly provisional counts of deaths by state, and select causes. And we go, and there's a database here. It has the U.S., and it breaks it down by state, and it has all sorts of interesting categories: all-cause mortality, natural causes, I don't even know what that is, malignant neoplasms, diabetes, Alzheimer's, like, you know, what did this person die from? There's no category. It's interesting that there's no category for the vaccine because it's safe and effective. So there doesn't need to be a category because nobody dies from that. So they have to put it in this sort of other category. So I've downloaded the numbers here, and I've done it for the United States since 2020. And as you can see, when you import it, and let me show you where you import it. So in order to import this yourself and see for yourself, you just hit the export button here. And the export button will just download the data to your computer, and then you can bring it up in Excel. And I've color coded and done a bunch of things just to save time here. But it's column O, which is this symptoms, signs, and blah, 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 unless not elsewhere classified. So it's category R00 to R99. So this is kind of the unknown. We don't know why this person died. It's not one of the, he didn't die from COVID. He didn't die from diseases of the heart. Okay. Now, you know, some COVID deaths, right, cause diseases of the heart. So that may be a little bit misleading here that it may not be counted, but it looks, you know, this looks, you know, 14,000, and here when COVID comes, it's even less. So it looks like it's not being counted in the wrong category. It looks like these things are being counted as sort of excess deaths. Now, when I say excess deaths, it's like 600, 600, 600, 600, 600, 600, 600, maybe 700. And then we start going up into the 800s. And once we start hitting over 850, that's when it starts to get interesting. Now, what date do we do that, right? Because it's starting to take off. So if we look over here, 1219, that's when the vaccination started. So interesting. We vaccination start, and look what happens to these numbers. They go into the four digits as soon as vaccination starts. So these are the CDC deaths. I wonder if it could be related. Now, so what I did is I did a formula here. I summed up these all of these deaths, and I subtracted out 858, which kind of is the sort of the baseline here, times 24. So I subtracted it out to see kind of, because this is like normal standard background deaths. So I said, okay, let's look at just the excess deaths. And when you do that, and you subtract out this baseline, you get 25,000 excess deaths. And I've talked to other people, I've talked to a bunch of people who estimated that the VAERS database is underreporting by a factor of 5 or so. So this kind of makes sense because we're looking at somewhere around 5 or 6,000 in the VAERS database. And we got 25,000 excess deaths. So, I mean, this is kind of how you can figure it out here, because you look at the excess deaths and you say, okay, well, probably most of them are from the vaccine because it sure looks like a cause and effect. So the VAERS data is showing like 5,000, and here it's showing 25,000. So you take the VAERS data, multiply it by 5, and you get, you know, a rough idea of the number of people who have died. All right, let's go back to our presentation. Now, 25,000 deaths, and that's just, and we're not done yet. You know, President Biden would like to get more people involved. And I know that Governor Newsom is offering like vacation packages, and they've got like, you know, 4 or 5 different vacation packages if you get vaccinated. So let's talk about stopping conditions. this is an experimental vaccine. And anytime you do an experiment on human beings, there's always a stopping condition for the clinical trial. And there's always it's always preset. It says, if you have 5 deaths, we got to stop the trial, look at the data and figure it out. It's done all the time. This is standard. So for vaccines, typically, because vaccines are given to a huge population, once you hit like 25 to 50 dead, and it depends the time and the political climate and all that, but in general, in our past history, it's always been if you hit 25 or you hit somewhere between 25 and 50, the stopping condition is usually within that range for vaccines. Now, if you have a kid's toy, it's even more strict. So if a kid's toy kills 4 kids, the toy is taken off the market. So does anybody know what the stopping condition is for the COVID vaccines? Well, I've asked, and nobody knows the answer. So for the COVID vaccine, the stopping condition is undefined. In other words, we are still not stopping, even though we're at, 1,000 times what we would stop before. This is like a runaway train. 25,000 Americans killed by the U.S. government, and we don't even let anybody know that 25,000 people have died. Now, we're supposed to have informed consent because these are experimental vaccines. Now, if they're considered safe, you don't need informed consent because they changed the law a few years ago so that they wouldn't have to do that. But if the vaccines are not safe, which we knew back in January, then informed consent is legally required. So someone's breaking federal law here. You have to disclose the risk benefit for each age range. You should tell people what the absolute risk reduction is. And by the way, you are risking your life in taking this vaccine to get an absolute risk reduction of probably around 0.5% or less. Because when they did the clinical trials, it was like 0.7 to like 1.3 was your risk reduction. But now half the population or almost half the population is vaccinated. So now your absolute risk reduction is much, much smaller because COVID is hardly a problem anymore. So maybe it's half of the amount, like 0.35. Maybe it's even less. Maybe it's even 0.2. So for that much of a benefit in terms of the risk reduction, you're basically risking your life and you're risking long-term disability. But people should be told, right? Because these vaccines are not safe. They should be told what the absolute risk reduction is right now for their age range. They should be told what the death rate is for their age range. But nobody is told that. I've gone to pharmacists and asked them, do you know how many people died from this? I've asked people in the vaccine lines, do you know how many people have died from this? Nobody knows. And in fact, nobody is even asking the question as to how many people have died, because we have all been brainwashed into thinking that it's safe and effective. Nobody dies. So why even ask the question? Because we're told it's safe and effective, and we trust the government. But we shouldn't. The government should tell us what the real death rate is. They should tell us what the adverse event rates are, including the rates for permanent disability. Like my carpet cleaner, right? He got the vaccination, and within 2 minutes, he had a heart attack. He had to spend the night in the hospital. He's never really recovered. He can only work like 2 days a week, and then it's really, really painful. He's lost like $30,000 in income so far from this, and expenses and so forth. it's tragic. And his wife also, she had like Parkinson's syndrome. She'd like hold up a cup and her hand was shaking like she has Parkinson's. She had no health problems before this. I mean, I've talked to people, I've seen emails of from a mother who had her 16-year-old daughter vaccinated, and 48 hours later, her daughter could not see and could not talk. Now, she recovered that, but when was the last time you had that happen to you after a vaccination? So these are not just anecdotes. These are very frequent events. I've talked to doctors and they've said they've never seen anything like this. And it's not one specific symptom because what happens is this vaccine creates these blood clots and inflammation that can happen anywhere in your body. And it's like totally random as to are you going to get myocarditis? Are you going to get a stroke? Are you going to get a heart attack? Are you going to get numbness in your hands? Are you going to get Parkinson's because you have neurological problems? I mean, this is like unleashing, sort of like random destruction in your body is what these vaccines are doing right now, because of the way they're constructed and because it turns out that the spike protein is not a harmless antigen, which they thought it was. So they made a bunch of assumptions, which turned out not to be the case. They made an assumption that the spike protein would stay on the cell. It doesn't. It breaks off, it cleaves off, and that spike protein can go and open up the blood-brain barrier and cause all sorts of problems. This is why people die. Anyway, getting back to informed consent, you also need to be told about alternatives to vaccination, which are early treatments. So if you get COVID, treat it early. And that's very attractive, right? So we should be telling you what your risk is, what your benefit is, and what your alternatives are. And my objection is that we're not disclosing any of that. And we're violating federal law. Now, they could change the law so, they can cover all this thing up, but I don't think that's right. Now, the alternative to vaccination is early treatment. Now, here are some early treatment studies that were done. This is from a website, c19early.com. It's done by a guy who remains anonymous because he's out of fear of retribution. And whenever there's a mistake that I find, and when anybody finds a mistake, he always corrects it. He's, I don't know if it's he or a group of people, but it's, you can find this c19early.com. And this was done today. So it shows you the results of the study of various studies of various drugs. And if studies are less than with three or fewer studies, it's shown in gray. So the stronger ones are shown in green. And this is early treatment studies. So these are people who just got COVID and are treating it with a drug. So you can see the proxalutamide is not on the market yet. Was very effective in the two studies. But fluvoxamine, which is a drug that I was involved in, and I was on 60 Minutes because I funded the study, has an 89% improvement. It was actually like 100% in both trials. So I'm not quite sure how he gets this, but two studies, 277 patients, and you can see it's the most effective drug, and this is a common antidepressant, SSRI antidepressant. It works because it stimulates the sigma-1 receptor, and it also modulates the uptake of serotonin into your platelets, so your platelets don't clump together and cause, so it basically calms down the inflammation. So all of these things kind of work, maybe with the exception of bromhexine, as inflammation modulators to lower the inflammation. Because typically, when people start their early treatment, they're doing it when they get symptoms. And when they get symptoms, it's kind of late for an antiviral. You're looking at making sure that the fire is out. So, fluvoxamine was very successful in two trials so far. There was the most recent study had 77 patients, and none of these patients got hospitalized, and none of them ended up with long haul COVID. So if you treat COVID early, meaning as soon as you have symptoms, go to your doctor and get a prescription and start on the medication. And even better, get the medication on hand, so it's sitting on your shelf. So as soon as you think you have COVID, start the medication, because starting early is so much more important than any of the drug choices that you make. There are a whole bunch of different drug protocols you can use, but it's all about starting early. So there's budesonide is effective, bromhexine, vitamin D. Here's ivermectin. You know, interesting that vitamin D, you know, is actually more effective than ivermectin. But we don't talk very much about that. It's only in 4 studies, and people don't like, oh, it wasn't a high quality study. But, you know, hey, vitamin D, you know, don't overlook that. And you want to load up on the vitamin D as soon as possible. So ivermectin, one of the big ones, 3,000 patients in early treatment studies. There are 24 different studies. And look at the error bars. It's all in reducing the risk. You know, so if you look at all of these, the error bars are all in, these things all work. Now, some people would argue that the evidence isn't like super high quality, but come on. You know, you look at hydroxychloroquine, sure, it works. Doesn't work as well as ivermectin, but all these things work. And then now when you start to get lower here, then there's a possibility that we don't know quite as well. But anything kind of above this line, all these drugs, all these treatments, you know, doctors should be using them, but they're scared. They're scared that it might not work and nothing will happen. But that's ridiculous, because all of these things, like vitamin D, they don't give you vitamin D. Like, what's the harm of giving you vitamin D? And if it really works the way it should, as the way these studies are, it's game changing. But doctors are afraid to do any of these until these are tested in very large clinical trials called phase 3 trials, which take about a year to execute. So imagine a virus which is more contagion. I saw the movie Contagion, which is great. You know, it's a fictional movie, but you know, the virus killed people in like 3 days. But the doctors, you know, so if we came up with like 20 treatments and they all tested out perfectly like this, the doctors would all say, no, we have to wait for large phase 3 trials. And trying to do a large phase 3 trial in something like Contagion is impossible. It is complete pandemonium. And so everybody would die based on how doctors treat patients today. It is absolutely absurd. You know, as an engineer, I look to try to minimize the number of lives. I mean, I solve an equation, which is what do I have to do to minimize the loss of life? Because loss of life is important. And if I have a supplement like vitamin D, which causes no harm and could possibly save a lot of lives, why not try the vitamin D, right? That's what I would do as an engineer. But no doctor, and I'm frustrated because no doctors don't think that way. They think large phase 3 clinical trials, or we can't use it. It is insane. So let me show you what the risk-benefit comparison is between taking the vaccine versus early treatment. So let's look at the relative risk reduction, right? So the relative risk reduction is these vaccines, you know, if you get a Moderna vaccine, it's like 90% reduction, which means a factor of 10 in terms of benefit. And I'll give you another factor of 3 in terms of the benefit, because they say if you do get COVID, then it's going to be less severe. So I'll give it an extra factor of 3. I don't want to give it more than that because it kills people. So, right, because right now it's killed, so COVID has killed 600,000 people. So 30X would mean that it would kill 20,000 people. But we know the vaccine itself has killed 20,000 people. So it can't be more than 30X. Now, for early treatment, in terms of the relative risk reduction, it's an order of magnitude larger. It's like 300X. And so, for example, and this is real life data. This is not a fake clinical trial where everything is set up. We're talking real life here. So it's Fareed and Tyson, which is George Fareed and Brian Tyson, friends of mine. And they have this big clinic. They treat a lot of patients. They've treated 6,300 patients. Average age is 60 years old. They've had one hospitalization And it's only because the guy got there late. He didn't show up. He was supposed to, you know, come to them for getting treated early. So one hospitalization is 6,300. Now, normally you'd see in his area like a 5% hospitalization rate, which is, you know, somewhere around 300 patients. So he had one hospitalization versus 300 hospitalizations. So that's a factor of 300 in terms of the benefit. And so that's why I say, well, you know, factor of 10. Now, if you add prophylaxis on top of that with like ivermectin, then you can probably add and multiply that by a factor of 5 or 6. And so now you're looking at, you know, 50 times better than the vaccine, which might kill you. And this early treatment stuff, nobody dies. So protection against variants, the vaccine, we don't know, right? Because the vaccine's like pretty specific. Whereas early treatment, because it's not specific, these are generic drugs, it's very robust. It'll hit all the variants. The risk of death from treatment for the vaccine is like 1 in 5,500. So it's kind of like, you know, rolling, not quite rolling the dice, but, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not, you know, for the flu virus, or sorry, the flu vaccine, it's like, you know, one death in maybe 10 million cases, right? So this is like 1,000 times more dangerous than the influenza vaccine. For early treatment, from the drug itself, from, you know, like ivermectin and fluvoxamine, like nobody dies from these drugs. Now, if you're suicidal and you take fluvoxamine, it's going to make you less depressed and you may kill yourself. But it's not the drug that causes it. It's just that it made you more likely to be happier so that you could kill yourself. So the point is that the drug itself does not induce suicidal thoughts. It just allows you to act on them. So assuming you're not suicidal, in which case your doctor wouldn't prescribe it to you, then it's, you know, sort of like on that order of magnitude of 1 in a billion, right? Which is a little bit higher than 1 in 5,500. Now, the risk of disability from treatment is somewhere around, and I have to estimate this, maybe 1 in 200, 1 in 300, maybe 1 in 400. You know, Tim's disabled and I know him and I don't know a lot of people. But the disability for early treatment, I mean, really, really small. I don't know whether it's 1 million, 10 million, but it's, you know. So the point is this, the vaccine is not such a great, when you compare it with early treatment's pretty powerful in terms of the risk reduction, in terms of the risk of death and disability. So it's a reasonable, if you don't have the vaccine, we're not like, you know, up the creek without a paddle. We still have early treatment. And in fact, I would argue that early treatment is going to be superior. Now, so let's talk about unethical behaviors. Someone sent me this and they posted it to Trial Site News as one of the comments in my article on Trial Site News. And we'll get to that shortly. So this is great. This is Robert F. Kennedy's soon-to-release book on the real Anthony Fauci. He characterizes Fauci as one of the greatest mass murderers in the modern world. Now, I'm not exactly a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, it's hard to argue with that, actually, because let's get to the next sentence here. Working in tandem with long-term partner, billionaire Bill Gates, Corral Americans towards a single vaccine solution to COVID, Fauci committed $0 to studying or promoting early treatments with various drug combinations that could dramatically reduce deaths and hospitalization. Meanwhile, in an assault on our First Amendment guarantee of free speech, Dr. Fauci's Silicon Valley media allies, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg, dutifully censored criticism of his policies on mainstream social media and collaborated to muzzle any medical information about therapies and treatments that might end the pandemic and compete with the vaccines. Now, that may sound like a conspiracy theory to you, but I can tell you, I could have written that sentence, you know, or those sentences myself, because I'm like sitting here wondering why these guys, the repurposed drugs are the fastest, safest, and cheapest way to end the pandemic. And when I saw NIH putting nothing into these drugs, I put in $1 million, I raised another $5 million, I started the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund. The government didn't give me any money at all. I didn't get money from a government anywhere in the world, and I didn't get money from a corporation either. So Google gave me, I couldn't even get 10 cents out of Google or Apple or Cisco or anybody else. Nobody, even the airlines, right? I had the fastest way to get the airlines restarted and, couldn't even get, calls returned, donations. So Fauci put in zero to this. He put in billions of this. I put in, essentially $1 million and raised another five. And we found solutions. So let me also talk about for a minute this evidence-based medicine. This is what all these doctors use to figure out what the treatment, the clinical practice guidelines are. And I want to show you how these guys are being very hypocritical here. So I'm going to talk about IVM is ivermectin, and I'm going to talk about mask wearing. Now, mask wearing, so this is the evidence-based medicine pyramid. So it says expert opinion, it doesn't count for much. Case series and case reports, the sort of anecdotal things, those count for a little bit more and are given higher weight. And observational studies with comparison groups are, next level up, and then non-randomized controlled trials, and then randomized controlled trials, or then even better is the double-blind randomized controlled trials. And then there's the meta-analysis and systematic reviews. And if you get this, then you're, it's kind of like the getting a royal flush. You always win, right? So whatever you've got a peer-reviewed systematic review, it's like nobody can beat that, right? So if you have randomized controlled trials, but you have this trumps everything, and so everybody has to pay attention to this. Guess what? There's a systematic review that was peer-reviewed for ivermectin. It's going to appear in a journal probably any day now. I've told Cliff Lane at NIH this, and you know what happens? Nothing happens. He doesn't even respond. They're sandbagging all this stuff. So I've told him, I say, I will give you proof that it was accepted so that you can now recommend ivermectin because we met the highest standard of evidence. Do you know what I got back from Cliff Lane at NIH? I didn't get back anything, nothing. Like it didn't even happen. I mean, this is the biggest thing. How? Finally, we have a systematic review that's on an early treatment drug that's inexpensive and effective. What does Cliff Lane do? He does nothing. He does absolutely nothing on this. Doesn't even return my email saying, hey, that's great news. We're going to get it all up. And as soon as that thing publishes send me the evidence. Send me the evidence of the peer review. That's what he should have said. He should have sent me the evidence that it passed peer review because then I can add it to the guidelines instantly. No. There is nothing. There is no movement. They don't want any drug to be effective. Everybody acts like there's no evidence, it's low quality evidence. Nope. They got peer reviewed. And you know what? When Tess Lowry, who came up with the systematic review for ivermectin, she had tried to get NIH to review it. They basically sat on their butts. They didn't do shit. They basically said, we're not going to do anything, so that way it won't get peer reviewed and we won't have to do anything with it. So they sat back on a very good systematic review and did nothing. So Tess kind of outsmarted them by submitting it to a journal and getting it past the peer review process. So now everybody in the world has to either put ivermectin on their practice guidelines or they're going to be a hypocrite. Because, they were said, we're evidence-based medicine. We believe in evidence-based medicine. Fine. If you believe in evidence-based medicine, you have to go put that thing up there. And so they could say, what happens if another systematic review comes in that disagrees with that? Well, that's never happened in history as far as I know. So you don't have to worry about it. But is NIH going to do anything? No, absolutely not. They, their guidelines are unchanged. They don't care. Their job is not to save lives. And if you look at the NIH guidelines, there's never a calculation made for the number of lives that are saved. It doesn't matter. The cost of life is not important to them. The only thing that's important to them is, did it pass a randomized control trial? So you could say, oh, well, no, but you know, there were 5,000 small trials and they were done in many countries and all 5,000 were positive. So if you had evidence like that, you would say, yeah, you know, ivermectin doesn't kill anyone and we've got 5,000 studies that are positive. Why not give it a shot? You know, because if it doesn't work, no harm done. But if it does work, then we're going to save a lot of lives. No, they don't think that way. They think, well, we don't want to be wrong. We don't care about the number of lives. We don't want to be wrong. This is how they think at NIH. They don't want to be wrong. They don't, you know, their reputation would be at risk. So, you know, that's what they do. They sandbag these because they want the vaccine to be the only treatment for COVID. Because if there is a valid treatment, they can't get the EUA for the vaccine, which is what they wanted. So they sandbag all this stuff, even when it's completely obvious. And by the way, the NIH and the WHO both know that fluvoxamine and ivermectin are in an interim result of a large phase 3 randomized control trial that they know about. They know that it's statistically significant for these drugs. They know that these drugs work, but they're not saying anything to the public because they don't want you to know. They're pushing the vaccine. So this is suppression of information that could have saved hundreds of thousands or millions of lives. And that's tragic. Now, look what they did for mask wearing. You know, by contrast, mask wearing, there was actually a randomized controlled trial that was done for mask wearing, but it was done after the mandate. When they did the mandate, they relied on expert opinion in order to mandate that we wear these masks. You know, and there were some observational studies, but they weren't for COVID-19. So, and the Cochrane review looked at these and they said very low quality studies. So, you know, they kind of had these observational studies and expert opinion on this, but hey, it was mandated that you should wear masks based on this low quality evidence. So interesting that mask wearing is mandated low quality evidence, but ivermectin, which has lots of randomized control trials and lots of double-blind randomized control trials and a systematic review, it's still not even considered. I mean, it's still a, we can't figure this out. You know, I think that's really, really bad. Okay, so let's talk about some unethical behaviors. So we already talked about there's no funding of repurposed drugs for early treatment, which is the fastest, safest, lowest cost way to end the pandemic. Man, we could have ended this so much sooner had they focused on repurposed drugs at the beginning. Now, when ivermectin and fluoxamine were proven in phase 3 trials, and both the NIH and WHO were notified, they did nothing. They just pretended like they didn't hear it. Cliff Lane ignored the precautionary principle. In fact, lots of doctors ignore the precautionary principle. So let's talk about what that is real quick. So I'm going to bring up an article, let's see, from, it's about face masks. It's in the BMJ, face masks for the public during the COVID-19 crisis. And it says that they argue it's time to apply the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle, according to Wikipedia, is a strategy for approaching issues of potential harm when extensive scientific knowledge is lacking and the evidence is based on the efficacy and acceptability of different types of face masks. But the point is that the precautionary principle basically says, hey, if you're doing no harm and there's a potential for good, then why not do it? And doctors, like, don't know this. It's like, they just do their clinical trials and the precautionary principle, which is what they should have applied in this pandemic. It's like, I can't find a doctor who even knows about this. But it's a real thing. And the other thing is, and this is a great article by Norman Dodge, and it's called Medicine's Fundamentalists. And It's about using all available evidence. And it's a long article, but I really urge you to read this. But it talks about using all the available evidence and not just relying on these randomized clinical trials. And it's, you know, individual case histories are mere anecdotes. I mean, I read this and all these academics that tell me, oh, it's an anecdote, and the plural of anecdote is anecdotes, and that's not data, and we have to have a large double-blind randomized trial. Bullshit. You know, this stuff, you really have to read this article. It is fantastic. And, you know, so it starts with, if the study was not randomized, we would suggest that you stop reading it and go on to the next article. I mean, this is the attitude in medicine today. And that is not practicing. That should not be the practice of medicine. But this, unfortunately, is what we've degraded to, is this. And this is why people die. So I would encourage anybody in medicine to read this and start talking to your colleagues about changing how medicine is done. So let's go back to our list. Again, the precautionary principle. He ignored the use all available evidence principle, which is, in a pandemic, hey, if you don't have those large phase 3 trials, take what you got. You know, so if you got maybe 5,000 smaller studies and they're all positive, probably should go with probably more likely that it works than it doesn't work. Now, unethical behavior. Fauci is the father of COVID. He actually funded it. It came out of the lab that he was doing the research, the gain of function research on. You know, you can tell that from the genetic sequencing. There's no doubt about that. He covered it up, and there are emails that he even covered up the emails by somebody illegally redacted this stuff. But, you know, any Democratic senator or congressman who's a committee chair can ask the NIH for the unredacted emails. But nobody's asking for the, you know, it's weird to me that Joe Biden says, I want to find out what the cause of this virus is. Was it natural or was it man-made, and who did it? Well, the answer is in plain sight. It's like, you know, the Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz, right? She always had the power to, you know, return to Kansas just by clicking her heels. Well, you know, Senator Peters or Congresswoman Eshoo could write a letter to the NIH saying, hey, can we please have Fauci's unredacted emails? And NIH will give them Fauci's unredacted emails, and we will all know for sure. No guesswork, because we kind of know that he covered it up. We kind of know where it came from. And when you see those emails, I guarantee you, everybody will know. But, you know, the Democrats, so why don't the Democrats ask for the unredacted emails? Why doesn't the press ask the Democrats why they're not asking for the unredacted emails? I've asked my own representative, who's Anna Eshoo, why she hasn't asked for the unredacted emails. And I get no answer. Okay, so fine. So we'll cover it up. You know, like, I don't understand. And the press should keep asking Senator Peters and Anna Eshoo and any other Democratic committee chair why they're not asking for the unredacted emails. I don't understand why the press isn't asking that question. So, Fauci let millions of people die by withholding early treatments and making it appear that they don't work. Because everybody in the world, with a few exceptions, trusts the WHO and the NIH. And if you go to India and you say, well, you should use fluvoxamine and ivermectin because you say you're evidence-based. And the official will say, well, it's not on the WHO or NIH guidelines, and therefore we won't use it. And in Brazil, they actually believe that early treatment doesn't work because that's what they're told. Because they can point to the NIH and say, here's proof There are no early treatments that work because it's not on the NIH guidelines. So people don't think anymore. They just rely on expert opinions of experts whose brains are completely out to lunch. I mean, there's really no other way to, you know, I'm sorry to say that, but there's no other way to explain it. Okay, now to compound things, Fauci is killing, 25,000 Americans more with the vaccines, and he's probably disabling, I'm only guessing because I haven't looked at, the numbers, but I did do a Nextdoor survey, and I asked on Nextdoor, and I got, over 100 responses, but, sort of not, it's anecdotal, but 4% of the people responded saying, yeah, I have disabling symptoms from the vaccine, and they're not going away. So I thought I'd be generous by saying it's only, 500,000. It could be 4 million or more. So anyway, it's a lot of pain and suffering that people didn't have to go through. And, and of course the Democrats are asleep. They won't even ask for Fauci's emails. I mean, really? And mainstream media refuses to investigate because they'll look bad because they were the one pushing the false narrative on the American people that the vaccine is safe. So now how are they going to come back and say, hey, just kidding, believe us now, the vaccine is unsafe. I mean, they can't do that. They will go and use their fact checkers to try to make me look like I don't know what I'm talking about. But you can look at all this stuff yourself. And there are lots of people that will verify this. And of course, then there's the other unethical behaviors is social media censorship of anything that goes against the narrative, the false narrative, TFN, the false narrative. So let me give you a simple example. So the vaccine has killed over 25,000 people. Maybe it's 20,000 people. Give me a break. It's available without a prescription. 12-year-olds can consent to this. And what does the FDA do? They want to accelerate the approval of this. And they want to get people to, the CDC wants to get, is like, their focus is on getting the shot in everybody's arm. On this that kills 25,000 people. Now let's look at this supplement, NAC. Now there are about 1,100 products that include NAC in them. And the FDA basically says, no, we're gonna, we just decided after 60 years of NAC being a supplement, and FDA just decided for like no reason. They said, well, we've always reserved the right, but now we're going to exercise that right to take NAC and make it a prescription drug, which means all of these manufacturers who've been manufacturing this are like going out of business. So after 60, now NAC kills zero people. So after 60 years, it now requires a prescription, whereas something that kills 25,000 people so far, that's available without a prescription. Now, the reason for that is because NAC can be used to treat COVID. So we want to take it off the market so people don't realize that. This isn't right. I mean, if you think this is right, I don't know how you could, possibly believe that killing people is available without a prescription and something that doesn't kill people requires a prescription. I mean, this is, I'm getting too emotional here. Okay. So let's end this here with some action items. The FDA, they should halt the vaccinations right now until they discover, what they have to do to fix the vaccines. And I think these vaccines are not fixable. I think the newer vaccines will work, but I don't think these mRNA vaccines, because of how they work, will work for COVID. Now they will work. They're brilliant. I really, I know I'm good friends with the inventor of the mRNA vaccine, and it's a brilliant technology. And when applied with the right to the right virus. It's wonderful because it can very rapidly be used to inoculate people against a virus. It's a really clever idea. But the problem is that when you have an antigen that is toxic, it doesn't work as well as the traditional vaccines. So anyway, we should halt the vaccinations and the current vaccines, which are gene-based vaccines, you know, that basically instruct your cells to manufacture the spike protein and instead rely on the vaccines, which put the spike protein itself in your shoulder where it stays in your shoulder and most of the time, and, you know, rather than instructing yourselves to make the spike protein. So halt the current ones, the gene-based ones, and restore MAC, right? Like, why do you do that? That's dumb. Or at least, you know, get up in front of Congress and explain how you're giving the vaccine without a prescription and you're requiring a prescription to NAC. I would love to hear that one. I mean, that could be on like Saturday Night Live, you know, when they give that explanation. So the NIH should update the treatment guidelines so that it includes all those repurposed drugs that I had on the previous slide that were clearly beneficial, including hydroxychloroquine. Because I funded the Bulwer study, but if you look at the shipment data and you correct the study, you find out actually that hydroxychloroquine works. But of course, nobody believes that because it's a, you know, Trump said it it worked and people don't like Trump. But look, based on the science, it works. And in fact, Fareed and Tyson use hydroxychloroquine all the time in their protocols. The other thing is important is to fire Tony Fauci and Cliff Lane, you know, give them an early retirement send off. Maybe you can, you know, at a minimum, Fauci should be out of his job and Cliff Lane should be out of his job. What they've done is inexcusable as far as I'm concerned. That's my opinion. The WHO, the World Health Organization, you know, people have called it something else, but I'll just call them the World Health Organization. They should update their guidelines to reflect reality as well. You know, I offered $2 million reward on Trial Site News. There's an article here. Let me see if I can find it. Breaking news, Novavax, should get vaccinated. Let's see. Well, we can bring it up right here. If you can prove. So there's this article here. If you can prove that the NIH and WHO got their treatment guidelines right, you could win $2 million. So I offered basically $2 million to anybody who could show that these two organizations got it right on their treatment guidelines. Seems like a pretty simple thing. And you can enter in the comments, or you can, you know, send me email and enter. And it's a fair contest. It's judged by JAMS. If we disagree, if I don't like your answer, we'll go to mediation and you win the money. But nobody has, you can see only 14 comments and nobody has applied because it's so ridiculous. You would have to show, it's open to professors, physicians, the executive manager of Frontiers who killed Pierre Corey's ivermectin article, any employee of the NIH or WHO. Anyway, all you have to do you either show it's more likely to fit the evidence than the recommendation for these drugs, or it's more likely to save more lives than recommending for these drugs. I mean, you know, perfectly reasonable conditions. Nobody can show that because they don't. This shows you just how bad, right? That nobody in the world, even with $1 million incentive, will go and defend the WHO guidelines. They're nonsensical. Okay, so next thing, medical schools. They should educate all physicians, all doctors, on all available evidence and the precautionary principle. I mean, this was left out of medical education, apparently. Big, big mistake. Social networks. They should now censor all content claiming that vaccines are safe. And they should enable people to report violations. So if I see a post that says the vaccines are safe and effective, I should be able to, like, you know, hit this button to report it. I think they have the report button, But it'd be nice if they had like a special report button just for safe and effective, because it'll probably be there'll be a lot of that, and so it's a little easier if you can just have a button for it rather than have to go several menus deep to do that. That's just a suggestion. YouTube, they should restore content and channels that claim that ivermectin, fluvoxamine, hydroxychloroquine work, because they do. And they should remonetize people's channels, right? Because a lot of people had their channels demonetized because they wrote that ivermectin works. They were telling the truth. They should not only should YouTube restore these, just like Thanos got rid of the these channels like that, and they should be able to snap their fingers and bring it back. But they should also provide financial compensation for these people that they harmed by demonetizing their channels and taking off their content. I think that seems only fair. Google is now running anti-ivermectin ads, so Google should ban anti-ivermectin ads. Twitter should restore the accounts of users who were unfairly banned, and there's a long list of those. For Facebook, I think Zuckerberg should step down for blind allegiance to Fauci. I mean, Fauci's like this, ringleader of all this, with this dangerous vaccine, and Zuckerberg is like just following orders, blind allegiance. I mean, like whatever Fauci says, and it's not like we're checking any of the stuff about early treatment or anything. There's no independent thought there. I mean, Zuckerberg has helped to. I mean, there were vaccine, side effect groups, like 70,000 users, 120,000 users. These things just disappeared like that. How do you take down 120,000 user group of vaccine victims, and all they're trying to do is exchange notes and figure out how they can, get out of the mess they're in? Because the doctors are like thinking like they're not even. They're treating the symptoms rather than it as, sort of vaccine victims. And so, I mean, that is so tragic that Facebook would do that. And, the Facebook employees are just standing by while all this happens, and they take no action. They're basically condoning it. So I think that if I was a employee at Facebook, I would think twice about the company that I worked for, and maybe choose a more ethical company that that respects human life. Congress should hold the people accountable for this. Doctors should add inpatient treatments, not just outpatient treatments, but they're inpatient treatments too. There are drugs like cyproheptadine and inhaled adenosine, which, if you ask a hospital to use it, they'll say no, it's not on our guidelines, and we're not interested in trying it. Even though these drugs have these case histories of half the time they take somebody in the ICU and extract them from the ICU, they go from lungs that are severely damaged to clear lungs in 48 hours. And if you try to get any hospital to do this, and I know for a fact because I've tried at my hospital, El Camino Hospital, and they wouldn't do anything. Like, I sent them the papers, I sent them the case histories, I offered to have them talk to the expert in the world on this, and they would have no part of it. They don't want to do anything different. And I guess maybe it's because they're looking at the NIH guidelines, which say, well, gee, if you treat within the guidelines, then we absolve you of any liability. And if you treat outside the guidelines, then if something goes wrong, you're liable. So instead of focusing on saving lives, they are essentially, legal liability. That's more important than saving lives. That's not medicine. That shouldn't be medicine. Social network employees, hold your execs accountable to truth so this can never happen again. I don't know how many times I have tried to talk to the executives at YouTube to say, look, ivermectin works. I'd be happy to debate you on this. This is really important. This is saving lives. And you can't get the time of day from these people at YouTube. I mean, I don't even get my emails returned anymore. I mean, it is, we're talking saving lots and lots of lives, hundreds of thousands of lives. And, you know, they won't even consider engaging the world expert, Pierre Corey, to debate them as to whether ivermectin works. It's like these guys just look at what's in Wikipedia, or they look at what the WHO says. And clearly those organizations are incompetent. And so YouTube is basically relying on this these incompetent experts. It's not right. Hospitals should restore privileges for those who spoke out. You know, there are people who wrote memos saying this vaccine is a huge disaster. And they filed the right reports and all that. So what happens to people who speak out against the narrative, against the false narrative? Well, they lose their hospital privileges. And what happens is that the case reports that they submitted are then torn up and discarded, right? Because they went against the false narrative. Words cannot describe the outrage in this. Parents, please don't allow your children to be vaccinated. Please educate them on this is not for kids. Kids are naturally immune to COVID. It's almost like they're pre-vaccinated. That's why so few kids end up with COVID. And if they do get COVID, then you can give them maybe 50 milligrams of ivermectin of fluvoxamine and 0.2 milligrams per kilogram of ivermectin, or just the fluvoxamine. I mean, look, 50 milligrams of fluvoxamine for a kid once a day, that will keep your kid from having, I mean, you know, I don't guarantee it. I'm not a doctor. You should talk to the doctor, of course, right? Because I can't give you medical advice, but I can say that, I mean, in my experience, I've seen amazing results with just 50 milligrams of fluvoxamine given once a day. So I wanted to just, since we're there talking about treatment protocols, this is the treatment protocol that I got from Dr. Bruce Patterson, who's an expert on treating long haul COVID. And so if it turns out that the drugs used for long haul, very similar to what you can use for acute COVID, which means you just got, you know, COVID. And so this is a list of the drugs and the doses for acute COVID. And then for treating long haul COVID, which is almost the same as treating long haul vaccine. So it turns out these vaccine victims, which suffer from, you know, shaking hands or pain or numbness or, you know, headaches and all this, the same drugs that you use for the vaccine victims are used for long haul COVID victims. Because essentially the vaccine is giving you COVID all over your body. It's just that it's not the virus, so it doesn't replicate. So these are the drugs. These are the four drugs that Bruce Patterson has found to be very effective. And if you go to covidlonghaulers.com, you can order this cytokine 14 panel. And once they have that, then they can tell you, you know, kind of what the right doses are, and you may not need some of these drugs, and you know, they may up the dose depending on what you have. So it's very, very scientific, and they use AI to do it. So essentially, they create this profile of you based on the biomarkers, and then the biomarkers are used in AI to determine what drugs that they will prescribe. So super scientific. I think these guys are the best in the world, and I'm not getting paid. I have no connection with these COVID long haulers at all, but I just think that the guys know exactly what they're doing and have had a just marvelous results for COVID long haul. So, summary. Vaccines are good, but the current COVID vaccines are unsafe. We need to educate the world that treating COVID early with repurposed drugs is more than a factor of 10 better than the vaccines, because Anthony Fauci has done nothing to tell people this message. It's all about treating early. It's all about as soon as you know you have COVID, as soon as you have a PCR test or as soon as you have symptoms, I don't care what age you are, please treat it early with drugs, because even 17-year-olds and younger, if the COVID is not treated, can end up with debilitating long-term side effects that will be very hard to cure. So that's why I think that all ages should be treating COVID early and take this virus very seriously. There's been lots of unethical conduct on a lot of people. I particularly want to call out Tony Fauci and Cliff Lane, because their actions have led to millions of lives that could have been saved. The FDA, CDC, NIH have been asleep at the wheel. You know, they should, you know, how is it this guy in Sunnyvale, California, and he's not even, you know, he's just a regular guy. I mean, he said, man, this thing is off the charts, like in January. Like the first week in January, he looked at the numbers and he said, holy moly, this is out of control. This is like the numbers were so high in just the first week in January that he said, there's something wrong with this vaccine. We shouldn't be seeing this excess death rate. And then, you know, Congress is blindly trusting the agencies. That's the big thing. You know, Congress has always deferred to the agencies, like they know what they're doing. Man, I mean, I hope this is a lesson that we will remember for a long time. And academia needs to embrace dissenters and not ostracize them. They had a failure to embrace use all available evidence and the precautionary principle. They need to really rethink how evidence-based medicine is used for treatment guidelines. And academia should never again, you know, let's make a lesson here that never again trust the FDA, NIH, CDC, phase 3 trials. You know, the phase 3 trials on these vaccines were perfect. They showed like no excess, nothing. They looked like super clean. So when these reports came out, the academics said, well, the phase 3 trials were perfect. So therefore, what you're telling me is an anecdote, and that's not science. Well, look, reality should always trump phase 3 trials. Phase 3 trials are artificial. Reality always trumps that. And you know, in academia, it's the other way around. When you tell people, huh, I got, you know, this side effect, they say, it probably wasn't the vaccine, because we showed in the phase 3 trial that the vaccine is perfect. And finally, that newer vaccines such as the Novavax, Covaxin, and Valneva offer hope. In the meantime, we can rely on repurposed drugs in the months. So there's a nice article here on Novavax, a little commercial here. Large study finds COVID-19 shot about 90% effective. It's effective against variants. And I really like the safety profile of this vaccine. So, and we'll see. And then it'll be compared against our existing vaccines. I guess maybe it won't, because our existing vaccines will be taken off the market. So I think we're almost done. So summary is never vaccinate the following two groups. Kids, because they're effectively already vaccinated and you're just taking risk. You know, everything has risk. Why take the risk? You know, it's they're basically already vaccinated. And if they come down with COVID, treat them early. Or if you've had COVID before, you're immune. And it's not really clear, like, where are the double-blind randomized controlled trials that tell you that you should go, if you've had COVID already, that you should get the vaccine? Like, was there ever a randomized controlled trial? No, you're just told to do it based on no evidence whatsoever, which is like, when it's convenient for them to say that you should do it, they don't need the randomized controlled trials. You know, that's what it boils down to. It's the hypocrisy of it all, and it's just horrible. The second thing is that if you're not in those two categories, then you should wait for a safe vaccine if you want to get the vaccine. And So the vaccines on the previous slide, the Novavax, Covax, and Valneva should be much safer. And the proof is in the pudding, right? When you inject, and if you don't have reactions within, say, 30 days of it, and it's there, everybody's mild and nobody dies and nobody has a heart attack, it's a pretty good sign that you've got a safe vaccine. So if you do get COVID in the interim, get treated as soon as possible, regardless of age. I want to put out a big thank you to Brett Weinstein, who's the of the Dark Horse podcast. And let me show you this podcast. So this is a 3.5 hour, this is 500,000 views. And 23,000 thumbs up. And let's see, this is like it's myself. Here, let me let's see if we can we may this may not work.
Hi, I'm Persephone Rose.
Whoop.
I flubbed
Yeah,
my
you
own
flubbed it.
intro.
Okay.
Stigma directed at those
this is
who
Robert Malone. He's the inventor of the mRNA vaccine. And this is Brett. And this is me, yours truly. So we talk for 3.5 hours. And some people have watched the 3.5 hours 3 times. And they learn a lot. So there's a lot of information packed into this podcast. So I encourage you to go over to Brett Weinstein and subscribe and maybe give him support on Patreon. But it's called How to Save the World in 3 Easy Steps. So thanks to Brett, because he was the one who broke the story. And now, of course, my Twitter is overloaded and my email is overloaded and everybody's contacting me on LinkedIn. So it's like I'm trying to dig myself out from all the positive response we got from that. Pierre Corey, who's been the champion of ivermectin, the tireless champion of ivermectin for the frontline critical care doctors. Tess Lowry, who did the review of ivermectin. And she, by the way, she also did this review of I forgot. She did this wonderful review of the vaccines. And she looked at the what are called the yellow card data. So this is the VAERS thing, but for the UK. And what she found here is her conclusion is that the MHRA, which is the regulatory authority there, now has more than enough evidence on the yellow card system to declare the COVID-19 vaccines unsafe for use in humans. So it's not just me, folks. It's and Tess is extremely well respected for her work. She was the one who did the ivermectin systematic review and organized that and got it through peer review. And she is extremely well respected. And look at all the adverse events. And these are everything in red is deaths. The UK numbers are smaller than our numbers, but the point is that it's not just me saying this. There are lots and lots and lots of people saying that these vaccines are unsafe. So thanks to Tess. Peter McCullough has been outspoken. He's just phenomenal. I talk to him all the time. George Fried and Brian Tyson have done wonderful work in showing that repurposed drugs can treat people with thousands and thousands of people with no hospitalizations. David Seftel, who ignored the advice of JAMA not to try fluvoxamine, he offered it to the people at the racetrack when there was a big outbreak, and he saved lots and lots of lives, and he saved people from having to suffer from long haul COVID by treating them early with fluvoxamine. Fareed Jalali, who's been a champion of cyproheptadine and also in our helping our understanding of how fluvoxamine works. And I'm a big Democrat, but I got to tell you, when I ask Democrats for help on repurposed drugs, I like the only guy who returns my call is Bill Foster, and he's not even my representative. But the Senate Republicans are speaking out, and there's a group of them that are basically fed up with Tony Fauci. And I think that's a good thing. And I'm going to be supporting their efforts to do that. And, you know, I would love to be supporting the Democrats, but they're still, you know, waving the flag saying, you know, go Tony, which to me is completely irresponsible. For more information, there's a great article. It's called Should You Get Vaccinated on Trial Site News. So if you go over to Trial Site News, it looks like this. Should you get vaccinated? It's got 8,000 likes, which is a lot for something on Trial Site News. I think maybe there's close to maybe 500,000 views. It's a super popular article. It's really, really long, I warn you. But it's really, really interesting, and it tells the whole story from, you know, puts all the pieces together. So I encourage you to do that. Watch the Dark Horse podcast when you have time. It's long. It's 3.5 hours, but it's super interesting and will give you a lot of insight as to how these vaccines work. And then finally, if you like what you've heard, then you can follow me on Twitter. That's my Twitter address, and that's also the same one used on Clubhouse. So that's it. I hope this has been helpful to people. It's nice to finally get this out. You know, a lot of people said, oh, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know the VAERS database. So I found several experts on the VAERS database. Thank you very much. Who confirmed all of this and, you know, confirmed the numbers. And I had an insider at Health and Human Services who verified all of this with the, I think the CMS database, which is the Medicare database. And so a lot of people contributed to this, to the information in this presentation. If you have any questions, you can DM me on Twitter. Please don't, you know, like I'm inundated, so I may not get back to you for like weeks while I'm digging myself out of a hole. I have to hire assistants and so forth to answer all the requests. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed this, and we'll see you on the next one. Bye.